Let's find Matthew chapter 24 tonight. We should be able to get started into the chapters that record the crucifixion of Christ tonight, I think. And we stop this morning with the fact that our key verse is Matthew chapter 24, verse 36, on which everything else that follows builds. So that if you were going to take Matthew 24, verse 36, down through Matthew 25 and verse 30, I would highlight verse 36 as the key from which everything else flows. Verse 36 is talking about the second coming of Christ and says, "Of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son of God." And so the remark in verse 36 is the day of his return is unknown. Now keep in mind with that, the time of his return cannot be known. However, he is made clear in the passage, especially in the parable of the fig tree, that when you see the tree leaf, you know that the time of summer is near. Time cannot be known, nearness can. Time cannot, nearness can be known. We do not know when he will return, but we know when it is known. And that is the stress of chapter 24 and verse 36. Simply think after verse 36 as everything else being a therefore. And the therefores that follow simply say that since we do not know the day, then we must prepare. Therefore, we are to prepare. And the preparation is discussed in 24, beginning at verse 37, clear through 25 through 30. All the parables in the following context, in some way, will be emphasizing preparation for the return of the Lord. And he will go back for the examples to, first of all, history. And that will be days of Noah. And then he will move from history to parable. So the first one is history. We covered that this morning. The history is found in chapter 24, verse 37. "For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah." And we emphasized what was going on in the days of Noah, namely the attitude was one of complacency, and the conduct was one of life as usual until the judgment came. Now, we started then with the parable, and we had the parable of the virgins, first of all, in chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. And we noted that the way this builds is in the parable that was recorded in chapter 24. The emphasis was on faithfulness and being sensible, and this parable illustrates it. And we stopped with the parable of the servants this morning. And now let's go to the parable of the talents, chapter 24, verse 14. 25:14. "Now, for it is just like a man about to go on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. And to one he gave 5 talents. To another, 2. To another, 1. Each according to his own ability, and he went on a journey." And again, like in all the other parables, like the virgins were expecting the groom to come, 5 of them were prepared, 5 were not. In this context, he's going to say, we don't just sit and wait. We serve. And the emphasis is going to be on the idea of service. As a matter of fact, when we went through the 10 virgins, what did they do while they waited? Well, basically, they didn't do anything except, well, chapter 25, verse 5. While the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. Now, in the light of that, can you see why he's going to want to add another parable? What does verse 5 imply? While you're waiting for my second coming, sleep. And that is not consistent. So he adds another parable, and this parable is going to say, you are to be working while you wait for my return. And this is the one where he gives out the the talents. So, verse 16, immediately the one who had received five talents went, now this is while he's waiting, went, traded them, and gained five more talents. What was he doing while he waited? He was acting in the interest of his master. In the same manner, verse 17, the one who had received the two talents gained two more. What did he do while he waited? While he waited, he served, and did so in the interest of his master. But he who received, verse 18, the one talent, went away, dug in the ground, hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who received five talents came up about five more, saying, Master, you entrusted five talents to me. See, I've gained five more talents. In other words, while you were away, I didn't just sit. I did something with your talents. Verse 21, his master said, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And as we said this morning, the principle here is faithfulness in little things always is rewarded by increased responsibility and higher position. Then the same thing happens with the man who had two talents, and he is rewarded. And then in verse 24, the one also who had received the one talent came and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, went away, hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. And his master replies in the words of verse 26 and says, You ought to, verse 27, have put the money in the bank, and on my arrival I would receive my money back with interest. Therefore, take the talent away from him, give it to the one who has ten. Then the principle is stated down through verse 30. So the parable is simply saying this. Time of waiting is to be a time of service. Time of waiting is to be a time of service. Remember the problem in the local church? Do you remember which one it was that had the problem? They were waiting for the Lord's return and doing nothing in the meantime. What was that? Church at Thessalonica, remember, was doing that in the book of 2 Thessalonians. They were waiting for the return of the Lord, and as a consequence, they weren't working. And that's where Paul writes and says, if a man will not work, he shouldn't eat. So as we anticipate the Lord's return, we don't merely wait. We wait and serve at the same time. Those are your parables built around the fact that we do not know the day or the time. Now, finally, to close out, and before we move into the crucifixion week, let's look at 25, verses 31 through 36, often called the judgment of the nations. The event in 25, 31 and following is the last event that occurs before Christ's kingdom is established on earth, and it reads as follows. This is 25, 31. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. And all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, Come, you are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I think that verse has a very interesting thought in it. Why do we think that God created this earth? The answer is obvious. For man to live on? No. God created the earth as a place for him to reign in. And notice, before the world was created, there was God's concept of that I want to reign as king. And it was, they are inherit the kingdom that was prepared before the foundation of the, before the world was made. God had the idea in his mind of reigning in a kingdom on this earth, on this world. Now, with this judgment, let me put a timeline out and make a distinction. Over here at the far right, we will put the great white throne judgment recorded in Revelation 20. That is preceded by the reign of Christ, the millennium, or the 1,000 years. Back here, we have the second coming of Christ, preceded by the Great Tribulation. Now, the important thing is not to mix the judgment of, or confuse, I should say, the judgment of Revelation chapter 20 with the judgment of Matthew 25. Because the one of Matthew 25 is going to be at his coming. The one of the great white throne is going to be at the end of his reign. One begins his reign, one ends it. So let's make some of the distinctions and list them out. First of all, when you look at the judgment in Matthew 25, is there any resurrection? Notice there is no resurrection there. When he comes, verse 31, all the nations will be gathered before him. So, Matthew 25, judgment, there is no resurrection. At the great white throne, there is a resurrection of the dead. It involves the resurrected dead. Or can we put it this way? Matthew 25 is a judgment of the living nations. Revelation 20 is a judgment of the resurrected dead. It's the first contrast between the two. Second, at the great white throne, only the wicked appear. In Matthew 25, you have both wicked and righteous. As a matter of fact, in Matthew 25, there are three classes, and we ought to note those three classes because we'll need to identify them. Coming back to Matthew 25, you've got verse 32, all the nations shall be gathered before him. He shall separate them one from another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So we're going to have the sheep as one class, the goats as a second class, but there's a third. And that is down at verse 40. The king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine. So we have a class called his brothers. So sheep, goats, and the sheep and goats are determined by how you created those, how you treated those that Christ called his brothers. We'll come back for identification on that in just a minute. Third contrast is in Revelation 20, there is only one destiny, the lake of fire. In Matthew 25, there are two destinies. Punishment or entering the kingdom. So they're different judgments altogether at different times. Now, the major thing in Matthew 25 and understanding it is who are the sheep, who are the goats, and who are the brothers? Well, let's go down to, let's suppose that we come down to verse 40 and the king answers and says to them, the question has been asked is, when did we treat you in this particular way? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did it to one of these brothers of mine. Interpretation number one. His brothers are believers. Someone find a problem with that? It should jump right off the page. What's your problem with that? If his brothers simply refer to believers, would you have another question? It's going to give you some problem. If brothers refer to believers, who are the sheep? Aren't they believers too? So I think that that interpretation really doesn't fit, and therefore I would take it to be that his brothers are believing Jews. And in the context, the sheep and the goats are determined on the basis of what? How did you treat the believing Jews during this period? And therefore, as the gospel is preached, you're going to have believers in this area, and you're going to have those that will relate to them. You say, well, since when did you get to enter into the kingdom on the basis of the way you treated the believing Jews in the tribulation? Well, I take it the answer to that is the way they treated them reveals the fact that they also were believers. So I would take it the sheep to be those who by their good treatment of the believing Jews in this period of time, in the period of the tribulation, have manifested that they believe the gospel. And therefore, he's looking at them from the standpoint of how their faith was manifested. How was it manifested? Well, down at verse 34, the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me something to eat." This is the evidence of their faith, the way they responded. "I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. Sick, and you visited me. In prison, and you came to me." And the righteous will answer in saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry, or feed you, or thirsty, or give you drink? When did we see you a stranger, invite you in, or naked, and clothe you? When did we see you sick, or in prison, and come to you?" And the king will answer, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me." In other words, their treatment of fellow believing Israelites is evidence of their salvation, and it's on that basis then that they enter into the kingdom. All right, now we're ready for the profound part of Matthew. Not that it all isn't that, but very, very great lessons as we study the death of Christ. And let's take a little quick look at where we'll be going. First of all, Matthew 26 and 27 will deal with the crucifixion of Christ. Chapters 26 and 27. Two major things are now in front of us. Crucifixion spelled right here. Crucifixion 26 and 27. And that, in turn, in Matthew's account, divides down to five parts. Five events that will be given in order. Number one, we will have a chapter, a whole chapter, 46 verses, of the events of preparation for the cross. 26, 1 through 46. That, in turn, will be broken down six ways. The setting for the crucifixion, the anointing for the crucifixion, the betrayal involved in the crucifixion, then the Last Supper, prediction of Peter's denials, and then Gethsemane. Those are all preparatory events. That is followed immediately. As soon as we leave Gethsemane, we have the arrest. Preparation 26, 1 through 46. The arrest of Jesus, 26, 47. Through 56. Then you have the trials. And the trials are 26, 57 through 27, 26. Then Matthew will give us the event of the cross. And he devotes chapter 26, verses 27 through 56 to that. And then he spends the closing time on the burial. That will be 27:57 through 61. And so those are the events that Matthew is going to lead us through. Notice probably, more than any other Gospels, Matthew dwells quite a bit on the events that lead immediately up to the arrest of Jesus. The preparation is from the setting through Gethsemane. In Gethsemane, the arrest takes place. Then, after the arrest, you have the sequence of trials on which Christ is placed. And then you have the cross itself described in some detail, quite a bit of time devoted to that, verses 27 through 56, and then the burial of Christ. And then the book finishes with the resurrection. And the resurrection is Matthew 28. All right, let's go then to the crucifixion of Christ, number one, preparation. And the events that make up that preparation, 26, 1 through 46. And the first thing to note is the setting, 26, 1 through 5. 26, 1 through 5. Now, when we read in 26, 1 through 5, the first of the final events leading to the crucifixion of Christ, you have a theme. And the theme is contrast. The contrast hinges on the little word then in verse 3. So let's read the first five verses as follows. And it came about when Jesus had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be delivered up for crucifixion." Then. And the then marks contrast. Then the chief priests and elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they were saying, not during the festival, lest a riot should occur among the people. And it hinges on that little word, then. So, the first two verses then is focus on Jesus. Then focus on the leaders. Focus on Jesus, verses 1 and 2, and how he stands in total contrast to the leaders. Now, what is the contrast? And let's put it under two expressions. First of all, his demeanor. How would you describe the demeanor of Jesus in verses 1 and 2? Let me put the words I would use and read the verses through and see if you don't agree. His demeanor was calm dignity. Calm dignity. Reading again those words. Came about, and notice how everything is in order. No panic, no pandemonium, no what are we going to do next or how are we going to get it done. Came about when Jesus had finished all these words, and notice how deliberate. He is now done. He has finished all these words. He said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be delivered up for crucifixion." Demeanor, calm dignity. Second, look at his words. And I would describe the words as follows. Confident prediction. Confident prediction. He knows what is going to happen, how it will happen, and when it will happen. Confident prediction. Now, set that in contrast to verses 3 through 5 and focus now on the leaders. And let's describe their demeanor in verses 3 through 5 in contrast to that of the Lord. First of all, what is their demeanor? And my word I would suggest to describe it that puts forth best for me is desperation. They don't know what they're doing. They know what they're going to do, but they don't know how it's going to get done. And in reading verses 3 through 5, can you see that? Then the chief priests and elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together. Notice they're putting together various plans to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they were saying, not during the Passover, lest a riot occur among the people. You see, we got to get rid of him. We can't seize him because of the people. And they had just had this little foray back in one of the preceding chapters where they tried to entrap him, and that fell flat. And so basically, it's desperation. If we focus on their words, I would use the words uncertain plotting. They don't know what they're going to do. And all of that is emphasizing the theme that is a setting of the cross, which is simply this. Jesus is in control. The leaders are desperate. Jesus can make an absolute prediction about here is what, how, and when it's going to happen. And he matter-of-factly puts that in front of them. In contrast to, Caiaphas says, well, let's try it. Wait a minute, we can't go that way. The people will lynch us if we go that direction. Let's go a different direction. Let's entrap him. Someone says, we tried that once and we got caught bad, so we can't go that direction. There's the contrast. That's what we're coming to and what Matthew wants us to see as we come to the crucifixion of Christ. On God's part, everything is in control. On man's part, everything is pandemonium. On man's part, it's plot and plan. On God's part, it is prediction. And therefore, Matthew says, just to get the setting for the cross, let me show you how things are in control. All right, now, as soon as we see the theme set forth in those verses, notice how this reveals the condition of the spiritual, end quote, leadership of Israel. Spiritual condition of Israel's leaders. If you know anything about the Old Testament, where would you expect, in the way the nation was set up, where would you expect to find justice? You would expect to find justice in the leadership, later on, the Sanhedrin of Israel. So, where justice would be expected, you have lawlessness. Where justice should be, there is lawlessness. And if there was any example of the most illegal, every single thing that is going to be done in the following pages will be absolutely, totally illegal. They didn't do anything legal in the crucifixion of Christ. That's why when we talk about the trials of Christ, that's not a very good word. Because when you talk about a trial, what's the purpose of a trial? The purpose of a trial is to get justice and let the defendant have his say, let the accusers have their say, and we'll weigh the evidence. Christ's jury was something else. Comes before the Sanhedrin, and they tear their clothes, and they spit on the defendant. Cool jury. Can you imagine a jury spitting on a defendant? That's illegal. You don't do that. That's contrary to everything. But this is the picture of Israel. There ought to be justice. Of all nations, it ought to have justice. It should be them, but it is not. All right? Notice, the spiritual leaders then were spiritual reprobates. Spiritual leaders were spiritual reprobates. Third, those who should have recognized the Messiah plot to crucify. They plot to crucify Israel's only hope. And that's the condition of the nation. Now, let's look at the prediction made by Jesus back in verse 1. And it came about that when Jesus had finished all these words, and I'd like for you to focus on one little important word. Notice, remember the words, when Jesus had finished, that's the marker that Matthew puts throughout his book to mark off these different sections. And those words occur. This is the fifth time in the book of Matthew that a division of the book has been marked off by these four words, when Jesus had finished. And inevitably, that verb, finished, is followed by direct objects. And in all five of those, the direct object was teaching. Now, let's go back and come down to the word we ought to focus on. Notice after the word finished is the word all. Note that in your mind. When he had finished all these words. Now go back to the first one, Matthew 7. And follow me up to the final time these words are spoken. And you'll find a lot of significance in that word all. Okay, Matthew chapter, this is the first time, Matthew 7:28. The result was that, here's Matthew's key repeated words for the first time, when Jesus had finished these words. Notice, know all these words. And I take it the reason there is no finished all these words is very simple. More to come. Second occurrence, Matthew 11 and verse 1. It's the second marker dividing off a division of the book of Matthew. And it came about that when Jesus had finished giving instructions, notice there is no all. Next occurrence is 13:53. And it came about that when Jesus had finished these parables. And next, 19:1. And it came about that when Jesus had finished these words. And now the final occurrence in 26:1. And it came about when Jesus had finished all these words. And we focus on the word all that is added. And what is he saying? We are now leaving the words of instruction. We are leaving the words and we are beginning or starting his work. Or, put it a different way, we are now through with the prophet. We are now looking at the priest. We are leaving the words, and we're now focusing on redemption. And it's Matthew's way, or Matthew's clue. And we will have, from this point on out, we will have plenty of words, but you're not going to have another Sermon on the Mount. You're not going to have another Olivet Discourse. The words are over. And therefore, the word all signals a transition into the emphasis here is going to be on the work that he is going to accomplish, not so much the words that he says. No more discourses. That's all over. And we're now shifting to something new. Notice also in verse 2 that we get a time marker. You know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming. And the Passover is 2 days away, and for the Passover to be 2 days away means the crucifixion is 2 days away. Notice in that verse, Jesus knew three things about his death. He knew, number one, the what his enemies were doing. He knew how things would culminate, and he knew when it would all happen. The leaders hoped for what would happen. They didn't know how they were going to get it done, and therefore they didn't know when they were going to get it done. See the contrast? Calm control versus the question marks of men. The certainty of God versus the question marks of men. Now, in verse 2, Jesus talks about the fact that he is going to be delivered for crucifixion. And when he says he's going to be delivered, that would raise an obvious question. It's passive voice. Something is going to happen to him. He is going to be delivered. If you'd been a disciple, what would one of your questions have been? Who's going to do that? He's going to be acted upon. Who is going to deliver him? And therefore, let's ask a who question. And the who question has two answers. The first answer to who will do it is in Matthew 26:15. Well, 14 to start the paragraph. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to deliver him to you?" So who delivered Jesus? Judas did. Answer of Matthew 26 and verse 15. Is that all? Keep your finger here. Acts chapter 2. So we'll get the full picture. This is the preaching of Peter. And Peter had been at the table when Judas betrayed the Lord. And now he is past the resurrection, and Peter is preaching. And Peter doesn't make a thing out of the betrayal of Judas, but he sees it from a different perspective. Verse 22, as he begins his sermon of Acts 2. Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God, with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man delivered up by the betrayal of Judas. Not at all. Delivered up by the predetermined plan and the foreknowledge of God, you nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. So the perspective of Acts 2 is God was the one or the agent of delivery. Acts 2:23. Which one's right? Both, obviously. We got an example of, how often do we put it? Making a distinction between primary cause, secondary cause. Primary cause, God. Secondary cause, Judas. Why do you have a primary and a secondary cause? How can that be? Answer, God is sovereign. Now, see if you can follow this. In Matthew 26, you're going to have a plot in verse 4 by the leaders to put Jesus to death. You're going to have another plot by Judas to betray him. And the interesting thing that's going to happen is this. The sinful plot of the leaders is canceled out by the sinful plot of Judas in order to execute the sovereign plan of God. Now, repeat. The sinful plan of the leaders is canceled by the sinful plan of Judas to accomplish the sovereign plan of God. And that is a great emphasis on who is in control. Well, I got this plan going over here, and God says, no, that plan that was going by the leadership, why couldn't he use that sinful plan? Because they planned to crucify him after the Passover. And Jesus had already said, I'll die on the Passover. So we're going to have to do away with that sinful plot. Well, let's see, Judas, your wicked mind, you've got another plot. And your plot will allow my plan to be crucified on the proper time to be executed, so I'm going to use your sin to overcome their sin in order to execute my plan. And who says God is not in control? That is a great picture of the sovereignty of God in operation, in the fullest sense of the word. Or we could put it this way. The source of the crucifixion and its plan is God. The instrument is Judas. That's a great way to be able to look at life. Joseph could do it. Looked at his brothers who sold him into Egypt. Looks them in the eye and says, you didn't sell me into Egypt. God brought me into Egypt. And it's another case of God used his sovereignty over the sin of his brothers to bring about salvation. God's sovereignty over sin is the only single thing that can bring us salvation. If God were not sovereign over sin, we would have no salvation. We would have no hope whatsoever. And it was illustrated by Joseph. Because of Joseph being in Israel, the Israelites are saved from famine. And the way he got down there was an evil plan on the part of his brothers. So God just reared back on his throne and says, I can handle it. I can overcome the sin of the brothers in order to bring about the salvation of Israel. And that's, again, being illustrated in this particular context. All right. As recorded by Matthew, we have reference to his death 12 times. And I think it would be worth our time to list out now, as we're coming down to the end, the 12 references to the death of Christ in Matthew. And see how they unfold. Matthew 9, 14 and 15 is the first. What we want to do is identify with the disciples who had heard all of this teaching from the very first mention of his death beginning in Matthew 9, verse 14. The first one is just a hint But it is the first time in the teaching of Jesus in the book of Matthew that we have a reference to his death. Then the disciples of John came to him saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus said to them, "The attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn." That would be a reference, of course, to the disciples, as long as the bridegroom is with them. So his answer to the question of why your disciples don't fast is as long as the bridegroom is present, they do not. And obviously the bridegroom would be himself, and the attendants would be the disciples. Now, latter part of verse 15, "But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast." And so the first hint of his coming death was he is going to be taken away. The words "taken away" are in passive voice. The bridegroom is going to be acted upon, and the first teaching is taken away. Second, Matthew 16:21. Second bit of teaching. Now, at this point, it really begins to become more specific. The first one is only a hint. But this one becomes more specific in Matthew 16, verse 21. "From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed and raised on the third day." And let me tell you, that was a shock. And the following shows it's a shock. "Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you.'" Now, the stress of verse 21 is on the word "must." When it says he must go to Jerusalem, you use the little Greek word "day," same word used in John 3, "you must be born again." And so the stress here is on the absolute necessity of his death. It's got to happen. Next, Matthew 17 and verses 9 through 12. And as this is after the transfiguration, as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead." And there is the teaching concerning his coming death. And his disciples ask him, saying, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" And he answered and said, "Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah is already come," and they did not recognize him, "but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." So again, second or third prediction. Matthew 17, same chapter, verses 22 and 23. "While they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And he will be raised again on the third day,' and they were deeply grieved." Continuing, Matthew 20, 22. Now, this introduces something new. This introduces into the teaching about his death the idea that it is a cup to be drunk. His death is a cup which he is going to drink. And this will help us to understand his prayer in Gethsemane, asking if this cup may be removed. Verse 22, "But Jesus answered and said, 'You do not know what you're asking for. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?' And with amazing spiritual perception, they said, 'We are able.'" So you have first, now the metaphor for his death introduced. Matthew 20, 22. 20:28. Now, Matthew 20, 28 introduces another new thing. This is the first time after all this teaching on his death that he tells us what it's going to accomplish. He said he's going to die, he's going to be killed. But he said nothing about what it's going to accomplish until verse 28. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." For the first time, he reveals the purpose of his death. Matthew 21, 33 through 46. This is in the parable, verse 33. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, built a tower, and rented it out to the wine growers and went on a journey. And when the harvest time approached, he sent his slaves to the vine growers to receive his produce. The vine growers took his slaves and beat one and killed another, stoned a third. He sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. But afterward, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the vine growers saw the son, they said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." And they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Then in the following context, he relates that directly to himself. Next prediction, Matthew 26, 12. 26, 12. I thought we would maybe get to this tonight. We will not. We'll get to it next time. This is where in the Jesus is anointed, and she pours out the expensive anointing on his head. And verse 8, the disciples were indignant when they saw this. What is the point of this waste? For the perfume might have been sold for a high price, and for the money given to the poor. Let me make an observation. Think about this until our next study. Who was practical? The disciples or the woman? Aren't they being practical? You poured out all this ointment on his head and can't retrieve it. You could exchange that for money and done something concrete for the poor. The disciples were practical. The woman is extravagant. Who gets rebuked? The practical disciples. Who gets commended? The extravagant woman. How do we explain this? Why? Why is practicality not the issue, and the extravagance is the issue? And that'll carry some wonderful lessons with it, but we'll have to delay those to our next time. 26:12. For when she poured this perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Reference again to his death. Now, the rest of them I'm not going to go to, because we'll be going through them. But they are 26:12. 26:21, 26:26 through 29, 26:31, and 26:39 through 44. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 of the 12 are in chapter 26. What's happened? We've turned the corner. And the emphasis is no more on the discourses of Jesus, the emphasis on the work of Jesus. The emphasis is no more on a prophet. The emphasis is now on the priest who is going to effect redemption and salvation for his people. Now we'll pick up next time with the plot of the leaders, and the plot of the leaders almost gets to the point of being, if it weren't so tragic, it would be humorous. So let me close out emphasizing the absolute control. When the leaders wanted to take him, he escaped. That was back in John chapter 10. When they did not want to take him, which was on Passover, they were forced to take him. He died on a day that the leadership rejected, Passover. And he died in a way that the leaders could not perform. They couldn't put him on the cross without Roman permission. And it's interesting, just as though God were saying, "You fools, is this the way you want it? Then I will do the opposite. Is this the way you plan it? Then I plan it differently. Is this the way you want to do it? Then I will do it the opposite." And it's just as though God were saying to them, "I am in control," which he obviously is. And it is amusing in the context to see every plot and plan is in the hands of God. And though it comes from them, if there's anything that is stately and magnificent in Matthew 26, it's the absolute sovereignty of God in using sinful plans to bring about his sovereign plan of salvation. And it's also encouraging to recognize that he can still do likewise in the lives of his children today. And perhaps you have seen a sinful plot used by God in a way to bring your delivery or your salvation that you never dreamed of, and God can do it because He is in control. Father, we're thankful tonight for Your Word, for Your Son, and we pray that as we enter now into these last hours and behold the Son of God making the ultimate sacrifice for our sins, may we see Him in control. May we see that salvation is brought about by the initiative of God, and the resistance of man is nothing in the light of the plan of God to bring salvation. We pray that You'll open our eyes to the person of Christ as we now observe Him in the greatest suffering that ever took place, bringing about the greatest results that were ever accomplished by an act in all of history. In Christ's name.